Does the form in which we consume carbohydrate impact our ability to utilize it during exercise? Welcome to the Science of Getting Faster podcast, where we cut through the headlines, talk directly to the researchers to find out what their studies suggest, what they don't, and where their research is heading. On the podcast with us today, we have Dr. Mark Heeris. Welcome to the podcast, Mark.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks very much for having me here.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Today, we're going to be diving back into carbohydrate utilization during training and racing. If you haven't already listened to our episode with Dr. Podlogar, I'd suggest you listen to that first. And we did touch on this with Dr. Podlogar, but Mark, can you remind us what influences the substrates, as in carbohydrate, proteins, and fats, that we use during exercise?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to say is that typically when we estimate rates of substrate use during exercise, we typically just see protein as a negligible energy source. So we don't really see it as a large contributor to energy production during exercise. The two main things primarily that dictate our substrate use during exercise is the intensity and the duration of that exercise. So what we typically see is that as exercise intensity increases, we see a increase in the amount of carbohydrate that we use as fuel. And at the same time as that, we actually see a concomitant decrease in the amount of fats that we use as a fuel source. So typically, and some of your listeners may be already aware of this, but typically maximal rates of fat oxidation occur around 60 to 65% of VO2 max. After that point, what we see is quite a steep decline in the amount of fat that's used as an energy source, and at the same time, an increase in the amount of carbohydrate that's being used. I guess on the other side of the coin, as we exercise for longer, so as the duration of the exercise increases, we kind of see the inverse happening. So what we see is a small shift away from carbohydrate utilization as exercise progresses, and we see an increase in the amount of fat that's being used to fuel our exercise sessions, essentially.
Why is that?
In terms of duration or in terms of intensity?
The duration. Why, when we progress through our exercise bout, why do we see less carbohydrate being used?
So two main reasons. The first reason for that is is due to the fact that the carbohydrate pool, the storage pool that we have available within the body, is becoming depleted, essentially. So we've only got a really small storage pool of carbohydrate within the body, around about 500 to 600 grams in trained athletes within the muscle, and around about 100 grams that's stored within the liver. Now, if you compare that to the amount of fat that we have available within the body, even in the leanest of individuals, it's only around about 10% of our whole energy stores within the body is made up from carbohydrate. So as exercise progresses, we see a reduction in that already limited storage pool. But what we also see is we see increased blood flow to the sites where fats are stored. So we see increased blood flow to adipose tissue, but we also see the fatty acids that have been broken down from the adipose tissue are now actually being able to be delivered to the site of the muscle, where they're then able to be oxidized as a readily available fuel source.
Got it. So how much carbohydrate can our skeletal muscles use?
So there's two things to distinguish here. So when we speak about carbohydrate use, what we typically are able to measure in the lab is whole body carbohydrate use. So this is carbohydrate use from our endogenous stores, which, as I've just mentioned, are either muscle or liver. But then if we are consuming carbohydrate during that exercise bout itself, we also have exogenous carbohydrate oxidation as well. So we can measure whole body carbohydrate oxidation, which is a combination of the two sources. But we can also be quite specific in our analysis, and we can look at exogenous carbohydrate oxidation as well. So I guess that's one thing to account for. In terms of the exogenous use of carbohydrate, I think when you look across the literature, the highest rates of oxidation are somewhere in the region of around about 1.7 grams of carbohydrate per minute. Now, when you look at that compared to the rate of whole body oxidation, you know, the amount that we can consume would never be able to equate for that rate of whole body oxidation. So we can never, if you like, we can never fully account for whole body rates of carbohydrate oxidation through what we ingest in either sports drinks or gels or bars. But saying that, 1.7 grams a minute is the highest that we've seen within the literature. And that will probably account for around about 50% of our energy production during exercise.
Okay, so if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that the intensity at which we're exercising influences the substrate utilization, whether we're using carbohydrates or fats, as well as what's available to us. And do we have the stores within our muscles and our liver, as well as are we taking on enough to meet? You're saying it will never meet the demands of that long duration, high intensity exercise. Is that what you're saying? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I guess the point that I was trying to make is that our rates of whole body carbohydrate oxidation will always be higher than what we can ingest during exercise, if that makes sense. And you actually touched on a really important point there, is that as well as the intensity and the duration of the exercise, actually the availability of glycogen within the muscle can also dictate how much carbohydrate is used during exercise as well. So there's been some really nice studies performed probably around about 20, 30 years ago now. And they demonstrate that in some situations, if we're exercising with really low glycogen stores, that can actually have a bigger impact on the amount of carbohydrate or fat that we use above and beyond that of exercise intensity. So there's a number of different factors in play that are actually determine how much and what type of substrate we use during exercise.
Okay. Do we always prioritize, if there is glycogen available, will we always prioritize that over fats, even at the lower intensities?
Yeah, so typically, I guess if you compared the same intensity and you had an athlete with high glycogen and an athlete with low glycogen, the priority would always be to use the fuel that you have available to you.
Why is that?
I mean, mainly it's because when we look at the intensities that athletes train and race at, they are primarily carbohydrate dependent. So when you look at the type of intensities that are important to athletes, carbohydrate is the primary fuel source that's used by the muscle. And we've known this for probably over 50, 60 years now. When we look back to some of the early classical studies that show that when we've got low carbohydrate stores, we fatigue much easier. So really the message to the athlete is that carbohydrate is the predominant fuel source when you're interested in the intensities that athletes train and race at.
So in that way, it's very clear why we're trying to maximize, why researchers like you are trying to figure out how can we oxidize as much carbohydrate as possible.
Yeah, and you know, that really comes back to the point I mentioned earlier, that the carbohydrate pool within the body, both within the muscle and liver, is really limited. So if we solely rely on the availability of carbohydrate that we're able to store, we won't be able to exercise for very long. Once that glycogen becomes depleted, what we either see is that subjects either just completely fall off a cliff and they have to stop exercising, or we see a dramatic reduction in the power output or the speed that we can run at, for example.
What limits the our ability then? You said that at the muscle level, we can only absorb, or we can only utilize 1.7 grams per minute of carbohydrate. What about, do some athletes, are they limited by their ability to tolerate carbohydrates? Are there any other things before we get to that point?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the first thing to say is that figure that I mentioned before, 1.7 grams, that's the highest ever seen within the literature. So that's not a typical amount that you see being oxidized within the literature. I think they had to feed around 2.4 grams a minute of carbohydrate within that study to actually be able to achieve them rates of oxidation, which is really high, right? And it's not typically an intake that we see being consumed by our athletes. In terms of the limiting factors of oxidation, the primary factor seems to be the amount of carbohydrate that we're actually able to absorb through the intestine. There is a number of different factors that people have been interested in, things like the rate of gastric emptying. So actually, when we consume that carbohydrate, how quickly is it emptied from the stomach before it even gets delivered to other parts of the gastrointestinal tract? But I think when you take the whole body of evidence that we have available, it does seem that the primary limiting factor, at least, is the ability to actually absorb them carbohydrates that we ingest through the intestine, where it's then either delivered to the liver and then subsequently delivered into the circulation, where it's then available for the muscle to take it up and use as an active energy source.
Can you, just for our listeners, so that we understand the difference between absorption then and oxidation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess them two terms are linked together, but at the same time, there is small differences between the two. So absorption essentially refers to how them carbohydrates are transported across the intestine. So effectively, the goal of this is to transport as much carbohydrate as we possibly can across the intestine, where it then becomes available into the circulation. So it becomes available within the bloodstream, and then the muscle can then take up that carbohydrate, whether it's glucose or fructose or any other type of carbohydrate. The muscle will actually take that up from the circulation to then be oxidized as a fuel source. So I guess absorption comes before oxidation. And in order to oxidize as much as possible, we need to try and get as much of that ingested carbohydrate through the intestine to then become available for that oxidation.
And as you mentioned before, we have to be able to tolerate it to an extent that we limit gastric emptying before it gets to the absorption point.
Yeah, tolerance is an interesting one. I think I've seen a few researchers begin to try and measure tolerance, and that's purely done through a Likert scale. So just asking subjects to subjectively rate how much they're able to tolerate that carbohydrate. And I mean, we probably don't have the answer to this, but it would be interesting to actually look at whether tolerance is linked to any sort of gastrointestinal symptoms, and whether the ability to tolerate is linked to the oxidation. I mean, I guess intuitively that would make sense, because if the carbohydrates are not being absorbed through the intestine, they're essentially still sat within the stomach because they can't get out of the intestine, if that makes sense. So if you've got malabsorbed carbohydrate remaining within the intestine, that is one of the primary mechanisms by which you see some of these gastrointestinal symptoms, and probably also linked to the tolerance that people are reporting as well.
So these terms, tolerance, absorption, and oxidation, they're kind of like a pathway, one from the other to the next. Is that?
I'd say so, yeah. I think as researchers, we probably need to do a little bit of a better job to try and understand more of these things and how they're linked.
Okay. What does the current research say then with regards to the optimal volume, the source of carbohydrates, the ratios? What do we know so far?
I mean, I guess it's quite a complicated story, really, because it does depend on a number of different factors. I guess the main recommendations are that the type of carbohydrate that we consume and the amount of carbohydrate that we consume all depends on the overall intensity and duration of exercise. I think in terms of the study, I guess we're going to be talking about today, the reason why you see a lot in the literature of people using different types of carbohydrate, so primarily these are either glucose or maltodextrin-based carbohydrates, which are then combined with fructose, is that these two carbohydrates utilize different transporters within the intestine. And as we mentioned before, actually trying to get these carbohydrates through the intestine seems to be one of the limiting factors to actually how much we can oxidize. So typically what the recommendations are is that if we're consuming around about 60 grams of carbohydrate an hour, we can solely rely on single source carbohydrates. So typically what you'll see is this will either be free glucose, or what you probably more commonly see is that this is glucose polymers, which we refer to as maltodextrin. So these are essentially chains of glucose, which we call polymers. And that you typically see these in, you know, your commercial sports drinks that you can get off the shelf. So really, I guess up to 60 grams an hour, we can rely on these single source carbohydrates. And the reason for this is that the transporter that these carbohydrates use to pass through the intestine becomes saturated around about this intake rate. So the transporter for glucose or maltodextrin becomes saturated at around about 60 grams an hour. So if we want to consume more than 60 grams an hour, in essence, there's no point in that additional carbohydrate coming from glucose or maltodextrin because that transport is fully saturated now. So even if you put another 60 grams of glucose, if you ingest another 60 grams of glucose, you really won't see any difference in the oxidation because you can't get it through the intestine, if you like. So therefore, when you increase the amount that you consume above 60 grams an hour, probably all the way up to 120 grams an hour, we need to use another carbohydrate source that utilizes a different transporter. So typically what you see is that we ingest the additional carbohydrate from fructose, and that allows us to increase the amount of carbohydrate that we're able to consume and subsequently oxidize.
Does their fructose transporters, do they also become saturated at that 60 grams?
Do you know what? That's a great question. And I don't really think we have enough evidence to suggest that. I think the best evidence that we probably have is that when you look at the data that I mentioned before, whereby you see the highest rates of reported oxidation are around about 1.7 grams a minute, I'd imagine that around about 1 to 1.2 grams of that is coming from glucose, and the rest is more than likely coming from the oxidation of the additional fructose. So I think based on that, you can probably maybe speculate that the saturation of fructose, or maybe not even the saturation, but the ability to oxidize that fructose is less efficient than glucose. But that said, I think what happened with fructose is it goes through a number of different processes before it can actually be available to the muscle. So it might not actually be that we're not getting all that fructose through the intestine. It might be getting lost in other areas of the body whereby it's transported to the liver and subsequently converted to glucose and lactate. So it might just be that it's a less efficient fuel source than glucose itself.
Okay, so when we see people trying to push that envelope beyond, say, 120 grams, is the 60 grams of glucose, that's a hard and fast rule? Like, we can't absorb more than 60 grams. So are they therefore potentially getting more from the fructose?
Yeah, I mean, it's generally what you see across the literature is between 60 and around about 60 and 70 grams of glucose per hour can be oxidized. It's difficult to say. Like I mentioned before, the highest rates of oxidation reported come from the ingestion of 2.4 grams of carbohydrate a minute, which is obviously above that rate of 120 grams an hour that we've just mentioned. But I guess what you've also got to contend with then is the additional potential gastrointestinal symptoms that you get from really trying to push them boundaries. And I think really as practitioners and researchers and nutritionists, the message that we should be delivering to our athletes is that, you know, it's really a trade-off between maximizing carbohydrate availability and oxidation, but also minimizing them gastrointestinal symptoms. I don't think there's any real benefit of, you know, real small increases in oxidizing additional carbohydrate if you're then suffering really badly with symptoms and you can't even exercise for any longer because the symptoms are too much. So I think, you know, we need to be quite careful in really trying to push them limits too much. And like I said, it's really about finding the balance between the two.
Yeah, definitely. The ratios then that we consume them in, am I right in saying that is then guided by those limitations on glucose?
Yeah, so typically when the recommendations were to consume 90 grams an hour, I guess the suggestion was that we already know that the glucose transporter becomes saturated at 60 grams an hour. So I guess therefore by default, if we want to consume 90 grams an hour, it makes sense that we just top up that additional requirement with 30 grams of fructose. So that really was where that 2-to-1 ratio of glucose to fructose was born from. I think what we're seeing now is that as we start to go past that 90 grams an hour, we're starting to question whether that 2-to-1 ratio of glucose to fructose is optimal. And there's been a number of studies now to show that actually ratios closer to unity, so either a 1-to-1 ratio or probably more commonly a 1-to-0.8 ratio of glucose to fructose seems to be one of the optimal ratios for not only optimizing the oxidation of the ingested carbohydrate, but also minimizing the symptoms of gastrointestinal distress. And then things are probably related to one another, because if we're able to oxidize more ingested carbohydrate, then there's less malabsorbed carbohydrate, if you like, remaining with the intestine, and therefore by default we experience less gastrointestinal symptoms.
What do we know about the form in which we consume carbohydrates?
So I guess we know a little. There has been a number of studies performed around about 10 years ago now that has looked at the oxidation of different forms of carbohydrate. So these were liquid, so your typical carbohydrate-enriched drinks, gels, and energy bars. So this series of studies essentially showed that these formats are oxidized at similar rates during exercise. There was a little bit of suggestion from one of the data sets that the carbohydrate in the form of a solid bar, particularly towards the latter end of exercise, was actually oxidized at a lower rate when compared with a drink. And there's also a little bit of data to show that consuming solids in the form of a carbohydrate bar might actually impair performance during exercise. And this might actually either be linked to the potential reduction in oxidation towards the latter end of exercise, but also potentially to some of the increased gastrointestinal symptoms that you see when you consume these more solid types of carbohydrate.
Yeah, and that then leads us to your study. What was the question you had coming into this study?
I mean, I guess you've alluded to it. It was really that. I guess, you know, we did have a little bit of evidence to suggest that these forms of carbohydrate acted in a similar way to each other. This had never actually been performed within the same experiment. So they were multiple experiments across a number of different years that were performed. But I think one of the biggest things that we are also interested in is that we know from anecdotal evidence and also some field-based evidence that, you know, athletes aren't just consuming these types of carbohydrate in isolation. What they typically do is adopt this mix and match approach whereby, you know, they may consume half of the carbohydrate from drinks and then they might top this up with, you know, a little bit of a gel, a little bit of a sports chew or a bar. So we were also really interested in actually what happens when you combine all of these different formats together. Does that have any impact on the oxidation or some of the gastrointestinal symptoms that we measured during exercise?
Yeah, a well-needed question and a well-needed answer. So you were then comparing 120 grams of carbohydrates coming from gels exclusively, drinks exclusively, chews exclusively, and then a combination of all of those.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so let's jump into this study then. Who were your participants?
So the participants that we had were some of the, well, what we tried to do essentially was get some of the best local amateur riders that we could in and around the Northwest. I have to tell you, in research, finding participants like these is probably one of the most difficult things in research. But what I would also say is I think actually when you get these type of people into the lab and you show them the types of information that you can provide them with, it becomes so much easier. I think that the biggest thing is actually getting those people through the door. And it's really just about having good connections with local clubs and local riders. And I think, like I mentioned, once you get them through the door, they go on and tell the club mates and other people, probably not the ones that they race with actually, because they're probably doing themselves a disadvantage by doing that. But yeah, essentially we tried to get some of the best local riders that we could get our hands on. And I think that's what we did to a large extent.
How many participants did you have?
So we had 8 in the study. All the participants were male riders. What was quite nice about this study is I think that it was quite a homogenous group of athletes. So they were typically of a similar level of fitness. I think when you look at the VO2 max data, when you look at the peak power data, and when you also look at the actual power output that these guys were riding at during the experimental trials, they were all quite similar to one another. So we didn't have large variations in the power outputs that the guys were sat at during the experimental trials. And I think actually Tim mentioned this in one of your earlier episodes, but I actually think this is really quite important when you're doing these type of studies. You want to create a stimulus that is actually requires large amounts of carbohydrate. And also there's a large flux of carbohydrate through the system whereby you've got high rates of carbohydrate oxidation. Because I think, you know, if you've got riders who can't maintain these high power outputs during the 3 hours, which is difficult, especially indoors on an indoor bike, then I think actually your demand for carbohydrate is significantly reduced. And I think you lose a little bit of the ecological validity of the study, flooding the system with huge amounts of exogenous carbohydrate, when actually the demand for it probably isn't there.
Got it. That's a good advertisement for our listeners. People who listen to this podcast love the numbers. So get in touch with Dr. Heeris.
I like it.
Yeah, to participate in his studies. I've done that before. I was so, like, I wanted the numbers, and yeah, you're contributing to science. So it's
absolutely
a great thing to get involved in.
Well, so we've got plenty more studies to come. So
get your contact details, and people can keep up to date with what studies you're doing and how they can contribute. So the participants then came in for preliminary testing. Did this involve, and what was the purpose of that?
So I guess the first thing that I use preliminary testing for is just to meet the participants. I think it's really important when you do these type of studies to know that you've got people who are really committed to the process and to the study. And typically, you know, I don't want to stereotype, but I don't know if it's just cyclists, but they typically are really committed to these type of studies, which is really great. In terms of the lab testing itself, we essentially use these preliminary testings to perform lactate threshold testing. So this essentially dictates the power the subjects will ride at for the 3 hours. And also just to do some VO2 max testing to look at maximal oxygen uptake. It gives us an indication of how fit these riders are. So typically you'll know whether they'll be able to get through the 3 hours of testing based on their lactate threshold, based on their VO2 max testing. But also, again, just to kind of give something back to the riders and, you know, kind of facilitate their training based on this testing, which not a lot of them have access or availability to.
Yeah, definitely. Did you have to exclude any riders based on them not meeting those requirements?
No, we were really lucky. I don't know if that was just me being picky before we managed to get them into the lab. But like I said, I think generally the participants who are interested in these type of studies are the ones who are kind of at the top of that amateur level and are really trying to push the boundaries of their own training and performance by, you know, really understanding their own physiology and metabolism a little bit better.
Definitely. What were their instructions then prior to coming in for the experimental trials?
So I guess some of the main instructions that we give the participants are around prior exercise and nutritional intake. In terms of nutritional intake, we actually provide all of the participants with 24 hours worth of standardized dietary intake. So that involves me spending a lot of time in the supermarket picking up foods for the participants and dropping it at the house. But I think it's really important when you do these type of studies to control nutritional intake. You know, some studies rely on participants doing it themselves, recording their own diet and then replicating that across a number of weeks. But I think if you really want to be precise in these type of studies, you actually have to provide that food to the participants. So we provided 24 hours worth of standardized dietary intake based on the body weight of each participant. And we also provided a pre-exercise breakfast, essentially, that was consumed at home. The other instructions mainly related to restrictions on exercise. So for 24 hours prior to all experimental trials, we asked participants not to perform any sort of exercise at all. Was probably one of the most difficult things for some of our guys.
I was just going to say that. I think that might be more challenging than the 3 hours on the bike for many athletes.
And then I think even more so than that, asking these guys to refrain from any sort of caffeine intake for 24 hours, you can pretty much ask these guys to do anything on the bike. If you ask them to stay away from coffee for 24 hours, they look at you like you're mad.
Yeah, definitely. Was it the food that you were giving them? Was that high carbohydrate?
Yeah, so what we try and do typically is adhere to practical sports nutrition recommendations, which would advise a high carbohydrate diet prior to any sort of prolonged endurance exercise. So the diet that we prescribe is typically 8 grams per kilogram of carbohydrate, 2 grams per kilogram of protein, and 1 gram per kilogram of fat.
Would that allow their glycogen stores to be filled up?
It should get them pretty close to that. We know from experimental data that around about 10 grams per kilogram is seen as that practical one-day carbohydrate loading protocol. The fact that the participants were also completely rested for 24 hours before should also help, because you've obviously not got any sort of depletion from coming from exercise. So it should really get them in the region of maximal glycogen storage, if you like.
Did you get an indication of these athletes, their diets prior to the experiments, or even whether they were used to consuming carbohydrates mid-exercise?
Yeah, do you know what? That's a great question. And I guess firstly, I think it's something that we should definitely do better at when we're performing these type of studies. We did capture some of that information. So we asked typically what types of carbohydrates they would consume during exercise, and also how often they would perform these carbohydrate feeding practices during exercise. We didn't really perform any sort of associations or analysis on this data. But I think that is quite important. I think anecdotally, these guys were used to consuming carbohydrate during exercise. But I think, yeah, like I said, we probably need to do a better job of capturing this and actually understanding whether that has an impact on our results in the future.
Right. And maybe it's a different question that you're going into the study with. Yeah. So then what did the experimental trials involve?
So essentially the trials were 3 hours of riding in the laboratory. And then during this time, on each different occasion, participants were fed with carbohydrate at a rate of 120 grams an hour. And as we mentioned before, on each trial that came from a different format. So it was either carbohydrate in the form of a liquid drink, what we call a semi-solid, which is your typical gels that you get off the shelf, a jelly bar that is probably becoming more common within, I guess, sports nutrition products, and then a mix of them products. So we would consume a drink, a gel and a jelly bar chew across each of the hours during exercise. Following the 3 hours of exercise, we then performed an exercise capacity test to exhaustion. So this was essentially asking the participants to cycle at a higher output than they were cycling during that 3 hours, and essentially just hang on as long as they could to that power output.
That's so tough after 3 hours. Wow.
It was super tough. And I mean, it's difficult. I guess there's two ways of doing that. Either you perform an exercise capacity test to exhaustion, or some researchers might perform like a time trial. So whether that be a specific amount of time or distance, they're typically the two performance tests that you use. I'm not sure which one's better than the rest after 3 hours. But what we try to do is to simulate where at the end of a race, you might actually have a breakaway whereby the power output is actually increased. And really the goal of that sometimes is actually just to hold on to the pack as long as you possibly can.
Yeah, it definitely increases the application of your findings for sure. I noted that you controlled for the temperature, and I did wonder, do you know what impact temperature has on substrate utilization?
Yeah, it's. Do you know what? I think we definitely need more research in that area. There's not a lot of data actually showing the impact of temperature. I think probably the first thing to consider when we look at, I guess, manipulating temperature in these type of studies is that if you take someone from typical lab temperatures, which is around 20, 22 degrees, and then you go and put them in a heat chamber where they're sitting at 30, 35 degrees, the actual absolute power output that they'll be able to hold is significantly lower for that 3 hours. So really, inadvertently, you're then having an impact on the oxidation of ingested carbohydrate by doing that, because you're exercising at a much lower power output than you would be in them ambient conditions within the lab. I think the other thing that you also have to consider is that if you then start to become more dehydrated because you're in a hotter environment, you've probably got reduced blood flow to some of those key organs that are required for transporting that carbohydrate into the circulation. So if you're essentially taking blood away from the gut because you're trying to send it to the muscle and to the skin to cool down, you potentially reduce the absorption of carbohydrate through the intestine, or even potentially reduce the rate of that carbohydrate is emptied out of the stomach. So I guess to answer your question, that what you'd probably see is that if you had someone in a hotter environment, you'd see lower rates of the ingested carbohydrate being oxidized.
Got it. Yeah. Do you think, well, actually, we'll come back to your study now. The fluid that you were consuming in your experimental trials, I think I saw that it was 800 milliliters. Does that, ensuring adequate hydration then, would increase our ability to oxidize the carbohydrates we're consuming? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things that come from that. So I guess firstly, like you mentioned, maintaining the hydration status of the athlete is important, because, you know, what we don't want to see is that the dehydration having a negative impact on our ability to oxidize carbohydrate. I don't think we reported this data in the manuscript, but typically we limited body mass losses to around about 1% in this study. So athletes were losing about 1% of the body mass after the 3 hours of exercise. So typically you'd be quite happy with that. I think anything over and above 2-3% is where you probably start to see the impact of this. And then I guess secondly, the important thing to consider is that when you're consuming these carbohydrates with larger amounts of fluid, you essentially put a larger load on the gastrointestinal system, so on the stomach. And this seems to actually have an impact on the amount of carbohydrate that's oxidized. So there was a really cool study published a few years ago that it was in running instead of cycling. But what they essentially showed is that if you're consuming carbohydrate in a fluid and you're doing this at really regular intervals, but when you do this, you're consuming really small amounts of carbohydrate, actually the amount that's being oxidized is actually lower than when you consume the fluid and the carbohydrate at less frequent intervals. But when you consume it, there's a bigger volume of fluid.
Okay. So it's finding a balance between making sure you're hydrated but not adding an additional burden to your digestive system.
Sorry, no. So the ones who consume, in the study I just mentioned, the ones who consumed carbohydrate in the fluid at less frequent intervals, so I think they consumed 200 mils every 20 minutes, they oxidized more carbohydrate than the participants that consumed every 5 minutes in like really small amounts. So I think actually having a larger load at less frequent intervals might be quite important.
Okay, so what intervals did you supplement your athletes with?
So it was every 20 minutes that they would consume either the drink, the gel, or the chew. I think what's probably quite important to take from this study as well is that when we were providing the the gel and the chew, subjects were concomitantly consuming a matched amount of water with that. So the results might actually be quite different if you weren't to consume that additional water and you were just to consume, you know, the gel or the chew in isolation. I think actually, like we just mentioned, the gastric load would be reduced. Also, the overall concentration of the carbohydrate would be significantly increased. So actually that might have a negative impact on the absorption of that carbohydrate.
Got it. Yeah, super helpful to know. So what were you then measuring as your outcomes?
So the main outcome variable that we had in this study was really to understand the oxidation of the ingested carbohydrate. So when people refer to exogenous carbohydrate, they're essentially referring to how much of the carbohydrate that you're ingesting during exercise is being oxidized as a fuel source.
Okay, great. And you were also looking at GI symptoms to correlate that as well. Is that right?
Yes. So in terms of metabolism, we measured both the exogenous oxidation and we also measured whole body metabolism. So that gives you an indication of the overall amount of carbohydrate that's being oxidized. You can also look at the contribution of lipids to that. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, we also investigated things like the gastrointestinal symptoms. We looked at various plasma metabolites. So how did the different formats impact our blood glucose, blood lactate, various markers of lipid oxidation, such as glycerol and free fatty acids. And then I guess finally, we looked at some of the performance measures that we spoke about earlier.
Great. What did you find?
I think the main finding to take away from this, at least from the athlete anyway, is that regardless of the feeding format, we can actually oxidize high amounts of the 120 grams that are actually being consumed during the exercise. So across the drink, the gel, the chew, and even the mix and match approach that we mentioned earlier, we're seeing really high rates of oxidation, and that's not any different regardless. That's the same regardless of the feeding format that we use. In terms of the gastrointestinal symptoms that we recorded, I was actually quite surprised when we started collecting all this data that we really didn't see any sort of gastrointestinal complaints across any of the athletes that we used, regardless of the feeding format. So I think what we typically use is a Likert scale, 1 to 10, whereby we say, can you rate your level of discomfort for a number of different symptoms? And I think the highest rating of symptoms that we got was maybe like a 2 or a 3. And that's across the whole of the study. So there was really no complaints whatsoever in terms of gastrointestinal symptoms.
Characteristics that might be related to symptoms? For example, do you think the fact that they were all men at a specific fitness level had any impact on those symptoms?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to draw conclusions from the study given the fact that the symptoms were so low. And I think also the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the group was quite homogenous in terms of the fitness status. I think one of the biggest things that you typically see within the literature is that people with a history of symptoms typically are the ones that have reoccurring symptoms when you measure these things either in the lab or in the field. So people who've suffered with any sort of gastrointestinal symptoms previously will suffer with that when you're trying to feed them these carbohydrates on the bike. And I think, you know, it's definitely an early, I guess it's in its early stages of research, but there does seem to be some evidence to suggest that we can potentially train, as we mentioned earlier, the tolerance to this, and also potentially train the ability to oxidize carbohydrates more. I think there's probably two things for hardness. I think in terms of tolerance, it might just simply be used to actually feeling a little bit full when we're consuming these types of carbohydrates, and actually just becoming more accustomed and getting used to it. I guess that's more of a subjective and perceptual thing. But there is also one cool study that I think Asker Ukendrup led around about 10, 12 years ago now. And they demonstrated that if we supply carbohydrate during a block of training, essentially, so if we're regularly exposing ourselves to consuming carbohydrate during a number of weeks of training, we can increase our ability to oxidize carbohydrate after a number of weeks of training. So, there is definitely something in it. I think we need more evidence to try and understand what the factors are that actually dictate these things. But I think there's definitely some legs in that sort of work.
Yeah, definitely. Do you suspect, and I know this is all speculative, do you think there would be a difference between males and females then?
I'm laughing because we're probably halfway through a study at the minute that's looking at the oxidation rate in female athletes. It's not specifically comparing males to females, but I think what we've tried to do is use a similar exercise protocol and feeding strategy that will allow us to actually compare the data that we have in males and compare that to females. I think one thing I would say is that what you might see is that if the females are exercising at a lower absolute power output, typically what you see is that their demand for carbohydrate is reduced. So the whole body rates of carbohydrate oxidation are lower purely because they're exercising at a lower power output. I guess the other thing to think about is that females typically have a lower body mass, body size compared to male athletes. But I think if you look at the available data that we've got, there doesn't seem to be any correlations between body size and carbohydrate rate of oxidation. So I guess what's this space? I mean, the female athlete is probably one of the hottest topics in sports nutrition at the minute. So I guess in a few years, we'll have more evidence to answer them questions.
Yeah, well, let us know when that is published and we'll get you back on to chat about it. Do you think then are bigger riders who are exercising at I'm assuming that they'll be exercising at a higher absolute intensity and requiring more carbohydrate, are they at a disadvantage then if we're not able to consume enough to match that?
Do you know what? I guess that's a really good question, because like you said, if your body size doesn't really affect the ability to oxidize carbohydrate, then there is the potential for, you know, the bigger athlete to actually deplete more of the stored glycogen, right? I don't actually have the answer for you, but I mean, you know, it's definitely something to think about. I guess the only caveat to that could be potentially that if you have a larger muscle mass, being a larger athlete, then actually your glycogen or your ability to store glycogen would be potentially larger than a smaller athlete. So your endogenous stores might actually be higher than a smaller athlete. So even though you're potentially depleting more of that endogenous carbohydrate, if you start with more, then you might just end up at the same place and it might not have any actual functional difference. But that's all speculative, okay. I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of questions still remaining.
I should keep us busy for a few years.
Yeah, definitely. The exercise capacity test then, was there a difference between the trials for that?
No, so we didn't see any performance differences across any of the trials. And, you know, that is I wouldn't say in contrast to the literature, because there isn't a lot of it. But as I mentioned before, there has been some suggestion that solid forms of carbohydrate can actually negatively impact on performance. I guess the one thing to say on that is that it's suggested that this may potentially be due to gastrointestinal symptoms that are elevated with some of these solid carbohydrate sources. So the study that I'm referring to essentially showed that there was more severe gastrointestinal symptoms when we consume solid carbohydrates. And this potentially has a knock-on effect on performance, purely because you're experiencing more discomfort. So I think the fact that we didn't see any differences in the rates of oxidation and we didn't see any differences in those gastrointestinal symptoms probably explains the reason why we didn't actually see any differences in performance, which is in contrast to that previous study that I mentioned.
Yeah, so based on that, what are your recommendations to athletes?
I think the biggest take-home message from this study to the athletes, which they'll probably be quite happy about, is that what they were doing in adopting this mix-and-match approach, whereby, you know, they're meeting their fueling requirements using a number of different sports nutrition products, is actually an effective way of meeting these carbohydrate fueling requirements. You know, I think if you were to try and consume these rates of carbohydrates at around 90 to 120 grams an hour, if you're to do this purely through fluids, that can obviously be quite challenging. And it can, you know, it can also lead to a little bit of kind of flavour and format fatigue for the athlete, especially if you're doing this for 3, 4, 5 hours that, you know, some of the pro riders might be doing in the big tours. So I guess the message is really, depending on your preference, depending on, you know, the situations in a race, the environmental conditions, you can actually decide on, you know, the most preferable feeding format to meet some of these different requirements. And there's no real difference between any of the formats that are available.
Okay. What would you say to athletes that say, I can't consume that much sports products? Like, they would prefer to consume real food during those longer events.
Yeah. And do you know what? That's definitely something that I would recommend myself, despite the data that we've got from the study. I don't think, you know, this study's not trying to advocate the use of these sports nutrition products over and above the use of real foods. I think it's just that the methodology to do this is a lot easier when you have these type of products. We actually published a study, Mark Fell was the lead author on this a few years ago now. And in that study, we used sports nutrition products, but we also combined that with rice cakes. So it was a combination of solid foods and sports nutrition products. I know Mark spent a lot of time preparing all of them rice cakes for that study, so congratulations to him for doing that. But essentially what we showed is that, you know, using a combination of them products alongside the, I guess, real foods that you typically consume on the bike was still an effective fuel source. We essentially looked at 0, 45 and 90 grams of carbohydrate an hour, and we still seen that those 90 grams of carbohydrate were, you know, having a positive impact on both metabolism and performance. So I think really for the athlete, it's about, you know, picking a strategy that works best for them.
Yeah, definitely. It might just require a little bit more work when you're trying to figure that out with real foods.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah. Well, so overall, what would you like athletes to take away from this conversation?
I think, like we've just mentioned, that, you know, based on their own preferences and requirements, for me, that the real clear message to the athlete is that, you know, these carbohydrate four formats of carbohydrate are readily oxidized. It allows you to meet your fueling requirements, even up to ingestion rate of 120 grams an hour, without actually negatively impacting gastrointestinal symptoms. So I think, like we mentioned at the start of the podcast, you know, the goal for the athlete is to try and maximize the availability of carbohydrate while actually minimizing the potential gastrointestinal symptoms from doing so. So I think, you know, this offers a real clear take-home message for the athlete to do that, depending on their own preference, the environmental conditions, but also the situation in a race. You know, there might not be time sometimes to unwrap a carbohydrate gel or a bar. You know, if you're in a real fast breakaway or whatever it may be, and, you know, a drink is much easier to consume, or you've got really large fluid requirements because you're in a hot environment and you require more fluid than semi-solid or solid foods, it just gives the athlete more flexibility in their ability to fuel and meet their fueling requirements.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned that some upcoming studies that you have. Where can our athletes keep up to date with your work?
So I will confess I'm not the best person to follow on social media, but I promise I will try and get a little bit better. But you can follow me on Twitter, where normally we publish all of our group's work. All of my available studies and research should also be available on ResearchGate. And if they're not, people can always get in touch and just ask for copies of papers and any different questions they may have. I'll always be happy to answer them.
Yeah, great. And thank you for sharing your study with me as well when I asked. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.